Hello, hello. Hello, audience. Hi, hi. We're going to get started. We're going to get started here. Just thank you guys for coming out tonight. We always appreciate you coming out, listening to the amazing writers we have in this town. It's just an unending supply of talented, talented people. And we're so excited to have you here. Celebrating our 50th anniversary season at Hemingway's and the New Digs. So we're glad to have you guys here, glad to have new faces, new readers up here. First-time Hemingway's reader tonight, we're very excited about. I just want to say thank you. Thanks to Hop Farm for having us. Thanks to Herb over there. He'll be your bartender for this evening, so take care of that guy. Thanks to Carly, the manager, and to Matt Gowans, the owner. I've known Matt a long time, and very happy to be here. This place has always felt very homey to me, even when it was just that room over there, and the front room was all it was. But he's made it a really spectacular place, and they've really made us feel very welcome and very much at home. So we appreciate that. And thank you to Joan Bauer. I don't say that enough to Joan. Thanks to Joan. Seriously. Joan is the heart and soul of this thing. I'm just the pretty face. And, it wasn't that funny. I mean, now I'm all self-conscious. But seriously, I mean, I have just unending respect and admiration for Joan and what she has done with this series, and just very, very thankful to get to work with her and getting to know her better, and it's just awesome. So thanks to all these people. I'm just thanking people because I'm dragging out the time. I promised Kevin I'd drag the time a little bit. One more thing I wanted to mention before we do get started. Our good friends over at White Whale Bookstore up in Bloomfield, Ari, who works there, who did so much to help our series when we were stationed at White Whale. Ari is running their own new series called Metamorphosis, which is centering LGBTQ writers in the community. I believe it's going to be a monthly series. Its first reading is tonight. I had planned on being there, then I realized I had other obligations. But it's going to be a monthly series, I believe, so please check it out. I'm excited to go check it out, so just wanted to bring that to your attention. Also, more housekeeping. We're down one writer tonight. Richard Hamilton couldn't make it, so we're sorry that he can't be here tonight. We're going to try to get him back next season, hopefully, which means we're expanding the open mic tonight, so there are more spaces on the sheet, and I'm sure Joan will tell you a little bit more about that. So if you are a writer and you are thinking maybe the open mic, please, we encourage you. We have some time tonight, so we would love to hear you. And I think that's it. I think we can start this. So last time I read some poems by Diane Seuss that were about her sort of a bit of insecurity in approaching becoming a poet and learning about becoming a part of the long poetry tradition and workshops and all that craziness that we get involved with sometimes, and how hard it can be to find your place in this thing, particularly if you're on your own and you don't have the background. So those poems were a lot about like insecurity and such, anxiety of influence and things like that. Tonight, I'm going to read the opposite end of the spectrum. I'm going to read a poem by Frank Lima, and Lima's approach to the whole thing was just own the whole fucking thing. It belongs to you. The history belongs to you. Keep what you want. Throw out the shit you don't want. It doesn't matter. It's yours. Enjoy it. So this is called Incidents of Travel in Poetry. And it's for Kenneth Koch's birthday. He wrote this. We went to all those places where they restore sadness and joy and call it art. We were piloted by Auden, who became unbearably acrimonious when we dropped off Sangor into the steamy skies of his beloved West Africa. The termites and ants were waiting for him to unearth the sun and Elissa. The clouds were as cool as a dog's nose pressed against our cheeks. I notice your eggshell skin is as creamy as a lion's armpit as we cross the horizon on strands of Yates' silver hair. There is a light coffee flame in his eyes, guiding us like an old Irish house cleaner holding a candle in a black and white English movie. Yeats's lips look like an angry Rimbaud, illuminating poetry with his youth and vigorous sunlight. He knew eternity would vanish the sun at dusk. He caught it with a rainbow tied to his finger. There was nothing left after that. We crossed the equator, heading north, following Emily Dickinson's black bag, containing stems of her longer poems preserved in darkness and memory, like wild pearls thrown overboard to avoid capture by Spanish pirates. The islands below float by like water hearts in a child's aquarium. We are candy wrappers being blown across the waxed floors of poetry. We land on the Brooklyn Bridge. Whitman's passport face is grinning at the 19th century and the thorny arms of Gerard Manley Hopkins, whose head was set on fire by God's little hands, the hands that circumcised the world. Gertrude Stein is a match flaring on a young woman's pillow whose birthmarks have been stolen. We cross the green Atlantic into World War I. We are met by Rilke, dressed in his Orpheus uniform, wearing white sonic gloves that once belonged to a stone angel. Rilke offers us a glass of Amontillado made from Lorca's private stock of gypsy tears. The sherry is not quite as dry as Wallace Stevens' lush mango metaphors of familiar objects. Although Stevens' poems are fragrant, there's a lingering afterthought of pound on the tongue. Pound collected his misty feelings to make raindrops into European and American poetry. Vagueness became as sharp as a pencil. Our blue box is not allowed to attend Apollinaire's birthday party held by the august Académie Française on the Eiffel Tower. He is being awarded the Golden Frog Soufflé Award and a one-way ticket to the Greek and Roman past to spend afternoons with Williams, filling wheelbarrows with the 20th century. Both Apollinaire and Williams could hail a cab on Madison Avenue in any country. After the bash, we toured Paris and London with D.H. Lawrence, who kept stopping to relieve himself of the great mysteries of life whenever he went by a Bavarian gentian plant. He claimed he was writing poetry for his new book, Acts of Attention for Love Poems. Eliot was rebuilding London when we left. It reminded him of Detroit or Cincinnati or St. Louis. He was removing despair from the weather. He thought it affected people's minds and did not want to overload Mayakovsky's emptiness with old English churches that pray for water heaters and cloudless nights. Mayakovsky, on the other hand, insisted there were bugs in Russia who could write poetry just as interestingly as Eliot. The Russian winter is elegant cruelty compared with the English milquetoast weather. A man without a cloud in his trousers is not a man. Eliot thought this was the most boring statement he had ever heard. Although Cummings' poems appear unintentional on the surface, he did not act like a drunken amputee at the dinner table and always said pleasant things that came out of nowhere. His conversation was experimental, but logical, and he investigated words, mixing them on paper with a pencil. Cummings was all et cetera after a few drinks. We moved the sun to South America. Neruda had become an organic poet, writing about the fulcrum of yes and no. He wasn't home when we got there, so we went over to Allen's for some macrobiotic poetry. As usual, Allen was rolling incense and howling in America. Allen was always mystical and beautiful when he walked on the Lower East Side. When he stepped into the old Jewish pavement, he mystified the habitués. David Shapiro, the djinn of some atomic poetry, asked Allen what was the future of poetry in the borough of Queens. Allen placed the palm of his right hand on David's glistening forehead and said, "David, don't you know? The future has no future. It is very old and doesn't worry about its future anymore because it has so little left of it." Allen made suicide exhilarating when he wrote Kaddish. Finally, suicide could talk about the pain of living with unbearable beauty. Beauty was Frank O'Hara talking to Second Avenue with a diamond in his head. We were the personal details in Frank's harem of private lives when Leroy insisted on becoming black, abandoning us for a noble cause, according to Frank, who loved Imamu Amira Baraka. We were the details in Frank's poems, and living one's life was a detail in Frank's life. John Ashbery arrived from Paris on a plane made of expensive suits, shirts, and ties. Like his poems, he was sparkling and squeaky clean, dressed in elegant language. He is the daydream that had become a poet. His subject is to have no subject, perhaps a casual reference to someone special. He is a poet of the less obvious in life, the Sistina made of clouds. We crossed the equator on our way to a cocktail party for Gary Snyder. There is no other life for his outdoor poems, hitchhiking on hands-on love. Gary seems to have time to write poems about the notes in his life. Kenneth, on the other hand, has a paper cup full of wonderful poems. He can write a poem about a cathedral living in a paper cup. Kenneth travels everywhere with his paper cup. At a certain time of day, Kenneth finds room in his paper cup for perfect days and perfect moments. Perfect moments when Frank spoke to us. Perfect moments when Alan spoke to us. And they sang to us with human wings upon which we sleep. Thanks. Next up is Joan.